All right. So we're talking with Steve Lenman. He's a writer and activist out of Chicago. And Steve, could you begin by talking to us about your background? What drove you to your writing and to your activism?
Well, Matt, many thanks for inviting me on. It's a pleasure.
It's good to have you with us.
Have some time with you. I started very late in life doing this. I'm a retired small businessman, 35 years in a family business, and it was sheer accident that I got into this. I think I can make a long story short. I heard a interview with a noted academic in Chicago on a subject of concern to me, and I sent him a long email praising the interview that I heard, and I guess I put enough detail in it that he got back to me and asked, can I post this on my website? I was flabbergasted that he would want to do that. I said, oh, absolutely, please go ahead. And then he got back to me again and said, can you see if you can get other websites to post it? And I was flabbergasted a second time. I couldn't do it as a letter, so I had to rewrite it in the form of an article or an essay, which I did. And I ended up doing it again. I got a couple of postings from it, and I ended up doing it again, writing him a very praise-filled letter on the newest book that he had just published. And again, he asked me, can you try to get this posted, which I did, and I got a few postings. That's what got me going. Right after that, Katrina happened in New Orleans, and I was so upset with what I saw going on, the people being ethnically cleansed from the city, the government just totally ignoring the needs of many, many thousands of people, that I wrote an article about it, and I got postings on that. That's what got me going. One seemed to go to another, and now I just can't seem to stop.
And you've been to the Wharton School of Business as well as Harvard School.
Yeah, I grew up in Boston, went to Harvard. This is my 50th reunion year. Graduated in 1956. Back then there was a draft. I spent a couple of years in the Army. Much better time to be in it than now. It was peacetime. And the most exciting thing I remember in my 2 years was when the Soviets put Sputnik up. There was about 2 days of commotion, and then everything calmed down. That was the first entry into space. I had a little dog on board. When I came out, I went to the Wharton School and got an MBA, and I was a market researcher for about half a dozen years before I got into a family business, and only got into this writing game after I retired. It was kind of helped a lot, a great deal, because I've always been a reader, and read a little bit as I had time. And then when I retired, I began reading very, very heavily, just terrific people, people like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. And, oh, I could we could talk for hours on the great people I've read. They're the ones who've taught me everything, and I've used it. And I think what anybody gets back in school is the ability to think and to research. You've got to do it when you write term papers. And I just put all those skills to use and began writing. I'm nothing special. I don't think of myself as being a particularly unusual guy. The only thing about me that I would say drives me is my commitment, because what I see happening, and I'm obsessed to want to help people overcome the terrible abuses I see going on, so many of them, and committed by my government.
Well, that brings me to my next question. You've talked a lot about, or you've written a lot about, the corporate control of society. Your government, the United States government, is the most capitalist corporatist government in the world by many accounts. Could you comment a little on what you've called the corporate control of society?
Oh, it's such a big issue, Matt. Such a big issue. I think that may be the single biggest thing that so many people never even think about. Corporations, big, giant corporations, literally rule the world, and the people who serve in government positions at all levels, federal, state, local, everything. These are people who are virtually chosen by the powers in big corporations to be the ones to serve them. And the government literally is there to serve the big power interests, mainly in corporations, and to do it at the expense of the people. It's most extreme by far in the U.S. because most of the giant corporations are based here. But it's true in Canada as well. Canada is almost like the 51st state. We could talk another time about a couple of times in history. The U.S. Had their eyes on Canada and nearly went to war to seize a good chunk of the country that they wanted. And the most recent time goes back to, I think, either the 1920s or 30s. I mentioned this in one of my articles when the issue with Canada was the same as it was with Iraq, stealing the country's energy resources. Canada is very energy rich, and way back then, even though the U.S. had so much more energy of its own, all the oil that hadn't been used yet, they wanted to steal Canada's, and they wanted to do the same thing with Mexico. But it's the power of the corporations, Matt, that literally rule everything, even the power to decide whether or not the country will go to war, against whom, for what reason. And if anybody thinks we went into Iraq to liberate the people from a despotic ruler, they need to rethink that very carefully. We went in there to control the treasure that's beneath the sand, their oil resources, and the only reason that we wanted to get rid of Saddam had nothing to do with his despotism, anything he did to his people or anybody else. It was totally because he was independent, wanted to run his own country, and that was intolerable to the U.S. Either obey us, we're the boss, or we'll get rid of you and get somebody else in.
Well, let's talk about that for a little while. You've written an article called War Making 101,
mm-hmm.
a user's manual, and you lay out, I think it's 10 rules on how a country pushes its people into war, how they justify the war, and how they carry it out. Could you just lay out quickly kind of a synopsis of the 10 rules that you put down in your article?
I don't think I counted them. it's a number of rules, but it really goes back to the beginnings of our history, way back to even before 1776, when the U.S. became an independent country. I think I could preface the whole business by stating an astonishing fact that I learned in another book, that the U.S., every year since 1776 and even earlier than that, has been at war with one or more adversaries every year without exception. So I make comments that war-making is in the DNA of this country. No year at all that it hasn't been at war with somebody, whether it was the native Indians or the British or nearly with you folks up north or the Mexicans. It was one thing after another. But it's just a series of steps. I don't have them in front of me now, but it's basically picking targets that are always weak. You never attack anyone that can fight back. Saddam was helpless in 1991. We knew it. We knew he had no weapons of mass destruction. The only thing he might have had was some of the chemical and biological he had left, and the only reason he had that is because he got them from us. He had no nuclear. We knew that. And chemical and biological are not weapons of mass destruction. They can raise a lot of dickens over an area that they cover, but they certainly don't wipe out a city or any area more so than that. So pick a weak target. You got to get the language right. You've got to demonize the enemy to get the public behind you. If you can't get the public on your side, then you've got close to three strikes against you right at the outset. So you've got to get those things, and then all of the propaganda just kind of revs up the public, gets them concerned that there's somebody very dangerous out there, a terrible security threat that the country has to act to remove, because we are only doing it to protect the security of the public. The true reason is exactly the opposite of that. These are imperial interests. We're going to remove a ruler that won't play our game. We're going for a treasure that the country may have, like Iraq, the oil that they have. Everything being cranked up against Iran right now, it's the same exact thing. we're claiming that Iran's a threat because they're enriching uranium. Well, everything Iran is doing now is totally legal. Every other country that has a commercial nuclear program does exactly the same thing. That's not the issue. That's the ploy to scare the public that Iran may want to build a nuclear bomb.
Well, not to mention that the United States, Israel, and Pakistan are the three kind of largest holders of, not largest, Pakistan's not the largest, but Israel and the United States are the two largest holders of nuclear weapons in the world, and we don't seem to...
Oh, yeah, with the Russians, they have a few, too.
Right.
Well, Israel, Pakistan, and India have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. They are, all three countries are nuclear outlaws. Iran signed it. They're in complete compliance, where Israel, India, Pakistan are not in compliance. They're breaking the law, and they have stockpiles of nuclear weapons. Iran has nothing. The game is to get Iran's oil, and it's an open secret. Seymour Hersh, a great investigative journalist here in this country, has been tipped off by some very angry insiders that George Bush has already signed off on a nuclear war against Iran. It's hard to believe. A nuclear war against Iran using so-called bunker buster mini-nukes. Well, these minis can be made to any strength, but they most likely will be made to a strength anywhere from one-third to two-thirds the potency of the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima. But they could be made more. They may use any number of them if they choose to do it. These weapons apparently penetrate the ground somewhat deeply, explode underground, but it's a myth that the radiation will be contained underground. There's been at least one test observed, and there was a giant black, instead of a white, a giant black mushroom cloud. And when radiation tests were taken afterwards, there was radiation all over the place. We've got big trouble, man. Big trouble.
Well, I'd like to move from from one big trouble to another. In his latest book, Failed States, Noam Chomsky has written that the three biggest threats to the world are nuclear war, which we've kind of just touched on, global warming, or a democratic deficit in countries that can make positive differences with regard to the first two of these dilemmas. Could you comment on where you see global warming and the democratic deficit? How do we resolve these problems anytime soon? I mean, it doesn't seem like that the nuclear option is gonna be resolved anytime soon, especially, like you say, when George Bush has signed off on a war against Iran, a nuclear war against Iran, and there's no move to get rid of the nuclear weapons that they currently have. So where are we going with the democratic deficit, especially the corporate control of the society, and the global warming issue?
Oh, these are such big issues. I reviewed Chomsky's Failed States. The review was up on my blog site and a number of other sites. Chomsky talks about the real danger that the country will cease to be a democracy. I call it a sham democracy now, but literally a tattered democracy that could literally move from that to tyranny. And I think we're very close to it now. And the other great threats, I think he talks global warming and the whole environmental threat that could destroy the planet. And the other one would be a nuclear holocaust. Yeah, the danger is very great. I think the public is lulled to sleep not to think about things like this. But I write about them all the time. I can't do it the way Chomsky does. But he does it so brilliantly, but I've just echoed the things that he's been saying. These things are very possible, and we could wake up one morning and find out that here in the U.S., suddenly martial law has been declared, the Constitution has been suspended. I wrote a mini script on how it can happen, starting with a second terror attack. I would say flat out, from everything that I have read, I've read the detailed explanation, 9/11, I don't know who was on those planes. 9/11 was an inside job. It was either done by the U.S. or the U.S. was complicit in it, and there isn't even a shadow of a doubt that my government knew everything about it before it ever happened, including just about when it was going to happen. But the evidence is so overwhelming that it just, these things could not have happened without there having been a plan that involved an awful lot more than airplanes hitting a few buildings. The Twin Towers alone could never have been brought down by the heat from burning jet fuel. Impossible. There was a controlled detonation on both buildings that brought them down. So you start with that, and you see the whole world changed after 9/11, and the government is totally out of control. Two wars, more on the books. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela is very much in the U.S. as target sites, and I write about that all the time. If you like, we can get into that a bit.
I'd love to get into that. So you've written that they're plotting the fourth coup attempt. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's well underway now, and I think the CIA is down there making mischief. A U.S. Privately run but government-funded organization called the National Endowment for Democracy. I love this language. This is Orwellian language. These are people who do nothing but create mischief, but we give them lovely titles like the National Endowment for Democracy. It should be the National Endowment for Great Mischief Making. But there's trouble going on in Venezuela right now. There are student riots on the streets in a number of cities, and I just included that in an article that I wrote yesterday. Mérida is in southwestern Venezuela. There are student riots there. Apparently, a little of this is spreading to some other cities. Right now, as we talk, there's a 3-day OPEC conference taking place in Caracas. And the thought in country down there is that these riots are CIA, Chavez opposition instigated to embarrass Chavez and maybe even to do more than that. But the U.S. has tried 3 times to oust Chavez, failed. And there's not a shadow of a doubt that there's a fourth coup attempt in the works right now. Evo Morales may be included.
Well, let's
from
get,
Bolivia.
Yeah, let's get into that. You've written an article. You've written a lot about Venezuela on vheadline.com. And could you maybe just kind of outline Chavez's rise to power as well as Evo Morales's recent foray into the world of national, what the CIA calls radical nationalism, nationalizing the oil and gas industries of the country. And maybe if you could just talk about why you think the United States is trying to oust Hugo Chavez.
Let me answer that one first, Matt. Chavez, and apparently Morales too. Morales has only been in office 4 months. Chavez was first elected in 1998, assumed office in 1999, reelected in 2000. The whole Constitution was rewritten. It was rewritten and voted on in a referendum. So the people of Venezuela had a democratic referendum to decide if they wanted this Constitution. Just imagine if your country and mine enacted laws like that. Instead of secret meetings, midnight sessions, the people have no idea the law is being created. But the people overwhelmingly voted to approve this Constitution, which is a glorious thing. It does so much for the people that they never had before. They went from the darkness of night to bright sunshine once Chavez got things in motion. His program is called the Bolivarian Revolution, and oh, is it a revolution! It's based on participatory democracy. The people of Venezuela, ordinary people like you and me, have a say in how the country is run. They literally have a say. And Chavez even has a Sunday radio program, a 5-hour radio program, where anybody can call in and ask him something. And I've heard little clips from it with a translator translating. I heard one where a woman called in who had some kind of a problem with her land or something. And she's saying, Mr. Presidente, I can't get this settled with whatever it was. and somebody's taking notes, and he's going to look into it for this woman who's had some kind of a problem on her land. Now, can you imagine George Bush or Stephen Harper doing that? Can you imagine that? Well, this is what Venezuela is today. Before Chavez, it was an oil country run by the rich. The U.S. controlled everything, complicit with the elite of Venezuela, and this went on for decades. The people had nothing. 80% of them were in desperate poverty, probably couldn't get a meal to eat much of the time. The poverty rate, I just included that in a recent article, it was down to 44%. Pretty awful, but it's been cut in half. Just remarkable. Venezuelans get totally free health care, totally free education to the highest level, a whole range of other programs. They get help with their homes. Many build homes on land owned by the state. The government is making provision to give this land to the people so they can own their own land in their own homes. They have microcredit programs. They have special things to help in all kinds of things. They even bring their military into communities where there are community infrastructure or other things that need to be done, and the military works with the people. They are the people. They're the young people that are in the military. They could go into their own community where their own parents are, and they're doing projects to benefit the people. All these things are going on in Venezuela. I'm hopeful. I don't know for sure about Morales because he's too new, but he's begun to do a few things showing some of the early signs that Chavez did, wanting to help his people, nationalizing industries, not to expropriate anything from foreign investors. And Chavez is not doing that either. All the two of them want is a better deal, which is the same deal that any foreign investor would have to arrange with a government if they want to go from the U.S. to the U.K., to France, to Canada. They can't go in and cut a deal where it's all for the corporations and nothing for the people. That's all Chavez is doing. Why does the U.S. want to get rid of Chavez? Because he represents the greatest of all threats we know. A good example. A good example. That's the reason. They're scared of him.
Well, let's move to the 2008 elections, if we could.
Mm-hmm.
You've written that following other people like Greg Palast, that the 2008 elections could already be stolen. That there are already plans underway to make sure that the Republicans, through disenfranchising voters, through electronic voting machines, are going to make sure that they win 2008 elections. Maybe we could just talk about the 2000 and 2004 elections and what you see as having taken place in those elections.
Well, I'm in the process of reviewing Greg Palast's newest book right now called Madhouse. It's a terrific book. Greg did the greatest job exposing how the 2000 election was stolen. Gore won it. Kerry won in 2004. There were just lots of hijinks. It got more sophisticated in 2004 compared to 2000. The main battleground in 2000 was Florida, where they basically disenfranchised a lot of voters. The Republican governor and the Republican secretary of state just started deleting voters off the voting rolls. Then there were all kinds of problems with ballots being thrown out. Some of the listeners may remember the hanging Chad debacle in one county in Florida. There shouldn't have been any debacle at all. I mean, all of this could have been settled. They basically didn't count a lot of votes in Democrat areas. By one means or another, they threw out absentee ballots from Democrat counties. And they basically got it down to where it turned out Bush supposedly won. But the untold story even about that was that there never was the final recount because the U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to end the recount. And then 6 or 8 or 9 months later, they finally completed the recount and showed that Gore won and Bush lost. But they put that information in a big article about 25 paragraphs down So nobody knew about it. So Gore won in 2000. Kerry won in 04. It got more sophisticated. Ohio was the main battleground there. Also New Mexico. Same kind of stuff. They threw out ballots. They deleted voters from the rolls. Greg believes, and I don't know if I have a lot of respect for him. He does not think electronic voting machine manipulation stole the election. I mentioned in my review that I don't know whether he's on the mark on that, because they're so easy to program, and in some cases they've been caught where somebody voted for candidate A and two votes came out for candidate B. Well, we all know who candidate B was. Well, it could have been a senator or a governor in that respect, too. Greg thinks the fix is already in for 08 and the Republicans are going to take it, and he says they have one brand-new trick up their sleeve, and that's the Hispanic vote in the U.S. is getting to be a powerhouse. It's the biggest minority group. It's passed the black population by a very small percentage, but it's growing faster. Hispanics in this country do not like George Bush. The Cuban ones do in Florida, but most Hispanics don't, and the immigration battle we've had here has really turned many more against the Republicans. They want to disenfranchise them. They want to strike them from the polls or put up all kinds of obstacles to keep them from being registered, from getting to the polls, if they happen to vote, from having their vote counted, just a whole array of dirty tricks. Pretty sad. Does this go on in Canada?
Not really. We don't have that many voting irregularities, I guess you'd call them. We also have a minority government, so there's not that much power. They're not supposed to have that much power. The executive isn't. But, when you don't have a real opposition party in Canada, they get away with a lot. And Stephen Harper is actually doing what George Bush has done, which is try to marginalize the press corps by calling them the formal opposition, saying that they're demonizing him and they're throwing a tantrum, saying that they're all against him essentially. Maybe you could talk about that, maybe. But I'd also like to get into immigration, and I'd also like to get into oil if we still have the time.
Oh, sure. If I had to pick one issue that I thought was the most important one of all, it would be the power of the corporate media. And it is so, so potent here in the U.S. It's impossible to watch a CNN or CBS, let alone Fox News, which is about as bad as it possibly can be, and have any idea what's really going on, because they don't tell you. I like to talk about, and I write about, that what you get from them is propaganda, lies, and distortion. And what they won't tell you is a lot more important than what they will. And the number one propaganda channel in the U.S. is the newspaper that most people think is the one place they can go and find out what's really going on, and that's the New York Times. I call the New York Times the closest thing we have in the U.S. to an official ministry of information and propaganda. That is their role. That is what they do. The Judith Millers of the world, Judith Miller alone ought to be put in the dock and prosecuted, because she did more to deceive the U.S. public that Iraq was a threat to convince the public to be scared enough that we should go to war to remove Saddam. Every day she would have articles about what I like to call the now you see them, now you don't WMDs. Well, there were none. I knew it. Anybody who had any sense of history knew it. I knew it in the mid-90s. They were all gone. Scott Ritter was railing for month after month after month that he knew they were all gone, except maybe a little bit here or there that didn't amount to anything. The corporate media, they absolutely deceive the public, and still too many people get their news and information that way, mostly on TV, and it is outlandish. I like to just get a sample of what they're talking about on a day-to-day basis, but I can't stay with them long, because it's very painful listening to the way they report the news. When I know the truth and I hear what they're reporting, it's like news and information from two different planets. If people want a good place to get real good news, man, anybody can go online and find Pacifica Radio here in the U.S. Pacifica Radio democracynow.org, and programs like Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. There's another great program called Free Speech Radio News. How about that for a title? Free Speech Radio News. Democracy Now! Is an hour a day, 5 days a week, weekdays, including holidays. Free Speech is 30 minutes a day in the afternoon. And my favorite program that I recommend to everybody beyond all others is a program called Flashpoints Radio. They are the best of the best. I know both of the hosts who run the program, and anybody can find it at the Pacifica station, KPFA, P as in Paul, Frank, F as in Frank, kpfa.org. Comes on Toronto time at, I believe, at 8 in the evening, but you can pick up the archive at any time. I listen to it the next morning at breakfast, hour a day, 5 days a week. And you'll hear discussions about the most important issues like you never heard them before. Everybody listening to this right now should find Flashpoints Radio and listen to it every day, and your world will change. Compare that to the CBC, and then compare it to CNN, and it's like news from two different planets.
Well, let's stay in California for a while. California's been the center, the epicenter of the immigration battle that's been waging, that's been being waged in the United States. Over a million people have come out to the marches opposing the Sensenbrenner bill, opposing deportation for illegal immigrants. And recently, all this uproar has kind of affected the houses of government, and there was a watered-down bill that got passed called the McCain-Kennedy bill in the House, which permits workers who have been in the country for more than 2 years to work towards permanent status. I was wondering if you could comment, you know, in light of the Hispanic population becoming the largest voting population in the United States. In light of that, could you maybe speak a little about what you see the immigration battle, where you see it going in the United States?
Well, I'll tell you the cause of it. It in the first place, there would be no immigration problem if it hadn't been for NAFTA. NAFTA began it all. NAFTA was a scam. It was a scam. It's hurt all three countries, Canada, U.S., and Mexico most of all. Canada was a scam to allow big subsidized corporations, mostly in the U.S., to sell cheap products in countries like Mexico. So agribusiness was able to undercut, a million, 2 million Mexican farmers. They could no longer sell their crops, crops like corn, because the U.S. undercut them, and they were all put out of business. They were all put out of business. So we literally impoverished hundreds of thousands of Mexican farmers alone, and these people were desperate. They needed to find work, or they couldn't eat. So what could they do? All they had to do was wade across the Rio Grande, across the border, and come into the U.S. and desperately look for a job. These people never wanted to come here. They left their families behind, come to a strange country. They don't speak the language, don't know what they're going to find when they get here. But there never was this problem until NAFTA, and all of the anti-immigration stuff going on now, at the heart of it is racism. If these people were coming from Canada or from the UK or from France or Germany, you wouldn't hear any of this stuff going on because those people have white skins. But because these people have dark skins, racism takes hold. That's something else in the DNA of this country. I hate to say it, but the U.S. is a white supremacist country, and it always has been. Heck, we had slavery down here till the mid-1860s. The Kennedy-McCain bill, the bill that the Senate passed, it's a lot better than the Sensenbrenner bill, which probably would have matched anything coming out of Hitler's Germany. Oh, it is really an atrocity. I've written about it. I wrote an article called The War on Immigrants. The Kennedy bill is pretty bad. It's pretty bad, too. It may be watered down, but it's pretty bad. It wants to reenact a program called a Bracero program. They don't give it that name, but it's just one notch above slavery. it's getting Mexicans, whatever number, U.S. agribusiness, whatever else, and whatever other industry in the U.S. needs, to hire these people, give them no rights, treat them like dogs, pay them as little as possible. When they don't need them anymore, dump them, get rid of them. This has happened before in the U.S., and these people were just brutalized by this program. There were even many employers who take advantage of workers and don't even pay them. They'll use them for a little bit, back up wages, and then get rid of them, don't pay them, and then hire more to save money, and these people have no recourse. This is a terrible bill. All the people here now should be legalized and should be treated like decent human beings, which everybody deserves to be. It's a terrible thing going on. Just one more great abuse that the U.S. public knows nothing about. I took a lot of abuse from the article I wrote, including some emails from Minutemen. Do your listeners know who the Minutemen are in this country?
I do, yeah.
They're fascists. That's what they are. They are fascists. They arm the border, and they literally have license to shoot these people coming over the border. And the idea of the U.S. sending the National Guard to monitor the border, this has happened before, and what happens is these poor people get shot, and they have no rights. And the U.S. public doesn't even know about it.
All right, well, let's turn to oil now. Venezuela is, you were talking about the recent OPEC conference that's going on right now. And Venezuela is announcing that it would like the world to recognize that it has the largest reserves of oil in the world once you take into account its crude deposits, its heavy deposits, sorry. Venezuela has been offering oil and natural gas to the poorest districts in the United States. What is the American government's position with regard to Venezuelan oil? I mean, you talked about Venezuela being the threat of a good example. What is the threat of the oil in Venezuela, if it is a threat?
Well, the threat is that the Venezuelan people are getting the benefits from it instead of the U.S. corporations. That's the threat. Venezuela is an oil treasure. It really is. OPEC so far has not recognized this heavy crude that Venezuela has. But it's being developed right now. There are oil fields that are beginning to develop this heavy crude. Heavy meaning it's harder to extract. It's more expensive to refine. So it's not practical unless the price of oil goes up. So at $10 a barrel, Greg Palast writes about this, at $10 a barrel, only the so-called light sweet, easy to get out of the ground, easy, cheap to refine, only that gets counted, and that's what Iran has, Iraq has, Saudi Arabia has. Venezuela's got it too, but they have a lot more of this heavy stuff. But at $70 a barrel, you can go after that heavy stuff and refine that. And Venezuela claims it has 350 billion barrels if all their heavy crude is counted. Saudi Arabia, the official count is about 262. So Venezuela's got about a third more oil than Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's a pretty startling fact when most people think Saudi Arabia's got more than anybody. But there's even potentially more than that, and Greg writes about this in his book, and I wrote about it in another article where there are other kinds of oil. There's oil from tar sands, and there's also oil from oil shale. Supposedly, the U.S. Rocky Mountains has a couple of trillion, with a T, a couple of trillion barrels of oil that could be extracted from oil shale. Don't ask me to explain how you do this or how expensive, because there's a big argument with experts when you get into this. Some people say it's baloney. It's so expensive to get it to usable oil that forget about it. It'll never happen. And some people say the same thing about tar sands, that, again, it's too expensive to refine this. The figure I use for Venezuela, if you count their tar sands potential oil, is 1.36 trillion barrels of oil. Greg mentioned this in his book, and he quoted a former CIA oil expert now working for the U.S. Department of Energy. Well, I don't tend to trust the CIA in too much or the Department of Energy, but I think they're analysts. I think they try to get good analysts, and I don't think Greg would quote him if he didn't think that he was a guy that possibly could be credible. Well, this guy said it, not me, because I don't have any idea in the world. But if he's right, then Venezuela's got 1.36 trillion barrels of oil. Isn't that startling?
Okay, well, just wrapping up now. Steve Lenman, we've been talking with Steve Lenman, and Steve, maybe you could just give us the three most recent books you've read that have made an impact on your life.
Well, the three most recent ones have been the ones I've reviewed. I read Noam Chomsky's Failed States. Any book by Chomsky is absolutely terrific. I positively recommend that. Failed States. I've just read Greg Palast's new book on Madhouse. If you want to know why we went into Iraq, he'll tell you. If you want to know about the stolen elections, he'll tell you. If you want to know about corporations ruling the world, he'll tell you. That's what you get in our Madhouse. And the third book was I wrote an article called Hostile Takeover, and a U.S. journalist by the name of David Sirota wrote a book by the same title. His publisher sent me the book, and I reviewed that. His take was slightly different than mine. He concentrated on how the U.S. government is in the pockets of the big corporation. I concentrated more on the abuses to the people because of the power of the corporations taking it away from the people. Sirota's book is great, absolutely great. Anybody can find the review I did of it on my blog site. The Palast review will go up on it as soon as I'm done. I'd recommend those three books heartily to anybody. They are terrific. If you want to know how the U.S. is run by big corporations, read the Sirota book. If you want to know how the world is run, Chomsky, and the great dangers that we all face, read Chomsky's Failed States, and he can tell you better than anybody.
Well, great. Thanks a lot for being with us, Steve, and we'll talk to you soon.
Matt, I appreciate it. Love to come back anytime.
Great.